Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You know, forever to have racial justice and racial reconciliation in this country, we can't just talk about blackness or other people of color's identity issues. We also have to talk about whiteness. And white people don't do that so much. So this week on the Brian Lehrer Show, we have a special edition of our 30 Issues election series, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. In the spirit of reconciliation and the spirit of the show in general, this is not an accusation. This is an invitation. But it's an invitation about a piece of the conversation about race and equality in America that's too often overlooked. So during this week, we'll talk about how some schools in the New York area are having organized student programs about whiteness. We'll do that tomorrow. We'll hear from journalists, scholars, and historians about whiteness in American history and today. And in the narrow sense of the election campaign, we'll compare how Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton seem to relate to their own whiteness and the whiteness of their potential voters. That's very relevant in this election year. And we'll explore themes relating to whiteness from past presidential elections in a history segment later in the week. We thought we would begin in a simple way for this segment on day one by inviting white listeners to talk about your own whiteness. So what do you think it means to your life that you're white? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. This is a call-in for white listeners. And how do we define that? Well, we won't impose a definition, really. If you identify as white, you're invited to call in. What do you think it means to your life that you're white? Are you more proud, ashamed, or nothing on that spectrum of being a white American? Do you think you've benefited from white privilege? Do you feel you can't talk about your honest thoughts about whiteness or race in general because there's too much politically correct pressure? Do you feel responsible in any way to help correct past or present racial injustices, even if you didn't cause it? Have you had a moment of realizing a racial blind spot you might have had as a white person about anyone who's not? Or do you think you see racial blind spots that others have about you as a white person? As we become a nation with no ethnic majority, which is where we're headed, what do you think that means for white Americans, including yourself or your descendants? And do you think you relate to this generationally? If you're under 30, let's say, do you think you relate to whiteness differently than your parents did? Parents, how about you differently from your kids? Maybe some of those questions are conversation starters. The overarching question simply, what do you think it means to your life that you're white, white listeners? We have a great guest to launch the series and to help facilitate the conversation because he's been facilitating conversations among white people about whiteness for the last few years for a documentary film series. He is Whitney Dow, a Peabody and DuPont Award-winning filmmaker and educator, a research scholar at Columbia University, and founder of The Whiteness Project, an interactive investigation into how Americans who identify as white experience their race. The Whiteness Project has so far produced two documentary film installments, Inside the White/Caucasian Box, which featured interviews with 21 people of different ages in Buffalo, and The Intersection of I with 23 millennials, age 15 to 27, in Dallas. So Whitney Dow, thanks so much for doing this with us, and welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me, Brian.
White people are calling in, so while they are, let's listen to a few examples from your films to help get the conversation going. The first one is a guy named Eric, 27 years old, from Dallas, who says everyone thinks he's a Nazi. He's a guy with kind of a biker or heavy metal look with big spiky hair, a nose ring, a metal chain around his neck, and a U.S. Marines vest. Here he is for about a minute and a half. Eric, 27, in Dallas.
Like, I have to tiptoe through every conversation with any minority. Like, anybody who's not white or a minority, you know, like, I have to tiptoe around every conversation. I can't just, you know, talk to them like I do another white person, because if I just say the same kind of things or make a joke in the wrong context, immediately I'm labeled as a racist. And it's terrible. Like, I'm the furthest thing from a racist. But it's baffling and it's annoying that being white immediately makes me a racist. And especially when I have my mohawk and my skin on my head showing, oh, God, I'm immediately a racist. Everybody thinks I'm a Nazi. I can't think of any time that I've really used being white. I think my friends have used me being white more often because I do hang out with Hispanics, African Americans, and occasionally, you know, some Asian kids. You know, I hang out with them. And they usually have me take care of dealing with the police because of my military background. I flip out that military ID, and as well as my skin tone as well. They're like, the white guy can handle it. He can talk to the cops and say, sir, and he will turn into butter. That's usually how they felt about it. They're like, send the white guy. He'll make it all better.
Eric from Dallas and Whitney Dow's The Whiteness Project. Whitney, one of the reasons I found Eric interesting is that he seems to reflect these twin experiences of people judging him as a certain kind of white person because of his look, him feeling like he has to walk on eggshells with people of color, which we hear all the time, but also seeing and using his white privilege on behalf of himself and people of color he hangs out with when there's a police encounter, if everything in his story is true. What does Eric represent for you?
I mean, Eric was really interesting. I mean, he articulates, as you say, a lot of things that a lot of white people feel, this real confusion about how to both process their race as part of their equation of identity. Like, you know, whiteness is often the thing that's left out of the identity equation, is that when people think about I often ask people about how they define themselves, and they always list, well, I'm a mother, I'm Jewish, I'm this, whatever it is, and the whiteness is always way down at the list, where I would argue that your white-faced is the thing that most identifies you in public. And your identity really is the intersection of how you perceive yourself, all these boxes you check of identity, and how the world perceives you. And the thing about being a white person is that whiteness is the very first thing that people see.
And it's the very first thing that non-white people see. And I think when we live in a white majority country, it's easy to not notice it if you're another white person, or to not think about it with respect to yourself, as so many of your interview subjects described. Whereas I think if we heard a cross-section of interviews with, you know, Black or Latino or Asian Americans, it would be much higher up in their consciousness.
Absolutely. And this was really this whole project was inspired by me trying to understand the impact that race had on my own life. Is that I'd made a lot of films over the years. I have a Black producing partner, Marco Williams, and we were always making films about race, about people who weren't white. And so that trying to really understand that impact and recognizing, as you say, that even though white people don't recognize it, your whiteness is an active dynamic component that impacts every moment of every day in your trajectory through life.
Let's go on with another clip before we get to some phone calls from your package, and go even more deeply into white privilege this time with another of your interviewees from Dallas. This is a young man named Connor who also talks about encounters with the police.
There's been plenty of times where I have consciously taken advantage of the fact that I was white and you know, always kind of knew that if I got in trouble, that I could just get a lawyer, suit up, show up, and, you know, it was a slap on the wrist. I would be in jail if I wasn't white. You know, I've been arrested probably over 20 times. And, you know, the only thing I have on my record to show for it is a public intoxication. And there have been some hefty drug possession charges, and I've never served time. I sold drugs. You know, I basically did whatever I wanted to do, knowing that there was going to be absolutely no consequences, you know, as what kind of the past showed me. I never felt guilt at the time because I never thought about it. But now that you mention it, there is a little bit of guilt in there, just because, you know, me talking about it openly is making me realize, damn, I'm pretty lucky.
So what do you want to say about Connor?
Connor was amazing. He's one of the most like honest people I've ever met. And it was interesting. What happened with a lot of people. I do these interviews and they last for about 40 minutes. I only put up about a minute of the interviews. People can see them at thewhitenessproject.org. That he had this sort of revelation while we were having the conversation. And I see this a lot because most white people don't talk openly and honestly about their whiteness, and having someone ask them direct questions about the benefits of being white and how it impacts their lives, you could really see it in his face. And I think also that really, you know, I think a lot of us feel that way, that we can just suit up and show up and we can make things, the system work for us.
On the other hand, from your Buffalo interviews, you have Harold, a guy who looks to me around 70. Do you know his age?
I think he's about 68, yeah.
Yeah, an older white blue-collar worker who feels his race has been working against him. Here's a minute and a half of Harold.
Well, I guess I've kind of grown up to be proud of what I am in my race and whatnot. I see myself as having a lot more respect than a lot of these other races around the area, and how the young kids are today is terrible. It's my honest opinion that today the white race is the one that's discriminated against anymore. I have taken exams to get into skilled trades fields such as electrician, machine shop, machinist, and welding and all that, and scored well on the exams and stuff, but didn't get picked for the apprenticeship programs to get into those fields because the minorities had to fill them because of quota status. So that's my own personal experience with that, which I felt cheated. And it wasn't fair. They took the same test I did, didn't score as well, but yet they might have been 15 on the list when I was 2 on the list to go next and got bypassed because of minority requirements. Well, I mean, I talk about the racial issues. I don't try to hide them or stay away from them because they're there. And it's, I think the more you can get your feelings out on how you feel about it and where you're coming from with the issue, I think you'll be better understood. So that's why I didn't mind doing this, because of that reason.
So that's Jason from Buffalo in the Whiteness Project. And here's another Buffalo interviewee. I mean, that was Harold. This is Jason, a younger white guy who feels no responsibility for racism that exists.
Do I think it's beneficial for me to be white? Have I gotten any privileges like that? I would say no. Just plain and simple no. I think that, you know, with civil rights and everything, I think a lot of times that other minorities sometimes get more benefits than I would as being a white person. For some reason, some black people kind of hold on to the back in the day, the slave thing, or they feel they're not being treated right. Should slavery be something that, because it happened, we owe black people something more? Absolutely not. Like I said, it had nothing to do with me. It had nothing to do with black people living today. Maybe their great, great, great grandmother went through it, someone they never met, but it's in the past. There's been injustices done forever in human existence, and it's just something that shouldn't happen. But it doesn't mean I owe anyone anything because of it. I think it's hard to talk about race as a white person because I feel like maybe sometimes black people are just looking for a reason to tell you why you're wrong or tell you why you owe them something. If I was in a room full of white people, I would not feel uncomfortable talking about race. But if there were other minorities in that room, I might think a little bit different, and I might be a little bit more careful opening my mouth to not offend anyone or to potentially get in an argument or a heated debate.
Jason from Whitney Dow's The Whiteness Project. So you've really got the gamut there, from white people who see white privilege all around them and how they take advantage or can take advantage of white privilege, to the last two excerpts that we played. I don't know if you want to talk about those two guys in particular, or maybe just go on to how just talking openly about this range of feelings that white people have in America helps move us forward in a larger national sense toward justice and reconciliation?
Well, before I answer that question, the first thing I wanted to say is that they can't hear it on the clips on the radio, but each clip is followed by a data point, which frames the interview in a broader social context. So, for example, Jason's has a data point about reparations and how people don't believe in reparations.
Only 6% of white Americans think some kinds of reparations are necessary, right?
Right. And the idea is really to take these comments, is that I think it's very easy to hear people like Jason and things he say as being, oh, this is out, you know, he's saying this outrageous thing, when in fact he's voicing something that's a common feeling that many white Americans feel. I think many white Americans ask this question about what do we owe black people because of the past? What about, you know, how does affirmative action work? And then he also articulates this, something that I think a lot of white people feel very, very clearly is, I would not say this. I cannot say this outside of groups of white people. And when I do the production, I have an all-white crew, and it's structured so that white people feel comfortable articulating their feelings. But you ask, you know, why is it important?
Another one of your data points, by the way, before we get for some time into why is this important, because it relates to the thing that Jason said that might have made people's ears perk up the most. About too many black people hold on to back in the day the slavery thing, as he put it. 51% of white Americans think slavery is not a factor at all in the lower average wealth of black Americans.
Which is astounding, right? Which is really astounding. And I think I think that one of the things that we're having, we start having these discussions like, you know, the NFL protests that are going on, things that challenge our own narratives about how we see ourselves and our relationship to both our country and the past are very, very complicated. I think there's a big tension in white Americans' narrative about what it means to be an American and the history of discrimination and privilege that we benefit from today.
Let's take some calls. Natalie in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. I think I didn't know that the amount of white people who think reparations are necessary was so low. I guess it makes sense. But from my perspective, I feel white privilege like pretty. It's like every day, and I feel like I've. As a white woman, I feel like I've gotten a lot. I've gotten a lot of privilege from being white, but I also feel like it's my duty and other white people's duty to think about that and try to combat racism in your daily life as best you can. I think it's really easy for white people to overlook racism because we don't face it, we don't see it, or we don't feel it. I try to identify as a white American as opposed to an American because I think doing things like that just is a small way of recognizing something that is, as you said, very apparent as like my white face, and that making it putting it more forward is one of like the ways like I can kind of recognize my own privilege, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you say something really interesting, which I think is that that she says, I try and live this in my daily life. And one of the things is that I think that a lot of white people feel like just handcuffed. They don't know how to engage this. And what she really said was very interesting is that once you start tuning in to how your whiteness affects every situation, you start seeing opportunities to change your behavior and take action. And this idea that racism and injustice is outside of you or outside of your ability to take action against is very, very is something that I think a lot of white people feel, where once you start taking it personally, you see that, no, actually, you can change the paradigm with your behavior on a day-to-day.
So let's explore that for a second, because changing the paradigm with your behavior once you see it, does it mean giving away some of your own personal privilege, making yourself more at a disadvantage on an individual basis?
I don't know. I think more it's about, for me, it's about individual action. I can sort of, you know, talk about something that's very, you know, sort of slightly amorphous, but you will start noticing that when you have interactions in stores with clerks and how you're treated versus other people are treated in the store, just the eye contact that's made, it's like when you come up to a counter, and I had this experience recently at a food cart in New York, and I could see the person, this black construction worker walked up next to me, and we were both ordering. And by the way he was interacting with me, it was like the guy in the food cart was trying to create this relationship with me. There was a triangle there, mm-hmm. right? And I could choose to be on one side of the triangle. And by just turning to this man next to me and saying something, I can't remember what I said, hello, whatever it is, it immediately made us, we're both customers, and this is the guy serving us. I am not creating that side of the triangle with this white, two white people against this second black person.
And what was the triangle going to be as you perceived it? Was this vendor seeing you as a potentially valuable customer for the future who we wanted to establish a relationship with and wasn't seeing the black customer that way, or something else?
No, it's almost like we are together on this. Like you and I are the same and he's different. And you can because we were both white, as opposed to me, I was the same as the construction worker in a sort of heart because we're both customers at this food cart.
So, Natalie, do you have a specific example for yourself about how you try to, you know, give away, I don't want to put it in the wrong words, not give away the privilege, but enhance other people's privilege?
Well, I am very loud in my beliefs, and that might be one way of doing it. If I feel like someone is, I have noticed that in school, if I go to, I'm nervous.
It's hard, right? That's okay. If you can't.
No, I can't. So what I try to do is just notice when, if I'm in a space where that I'm seeing it as a white space, which I would, a place that, like, I think I would feel more comfortable than someone who isn't white, then I try to be aware of them and kind of try to be inclusive, or the way I stand and making eye contact and that kind of thing. But
very similar to the story, really, that Whitney was just telling about the food cart.
Yes, it's easy when you're in a meeting. It's who you look at in the meeting, and you'll notice a lot of times. I think it happens with men and women a lot too. Is that you'll be in a meeting and suddenly you'll find that people are just looking at the men or talking to the men and not talking to the women. So,
all right, this is day one of a week-long series here on the Brian Lehrer Show, an expanded special edition of our 30 Issues Election Series, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. We'll continue in a minute with Whitney Dow from the Whiteness Project, or whitenessproject.org, with more interview excerpts from his pieces and more of your phone calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, day one of a week-long expanded edition of our 30 Issues Election Series, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. Today with Whitney Dow, a Peabody and DuPont Award-winning filmmaker. He produced films including Freedom Summer, Banished, The Undocumented, Toots, and Among the Believers. Maybe you know one or more of those films that Whitney Dow produced. And for the last 5 years or so, he's been doing what he calls the Whiteness Project, interviewing white people in various places in America about their whiteness, an interactive investigation into how Americans who identify as white experience their race, as he puts it. We'll hear another clip from the Whiteness Project film installments coming up. But right now, let's go to another phone call on our board as we're asking the same question. Let's see. Michael in the East Village. You're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Good morning. I'm very glad to be talking about this subject. I have 3 points I really want to make. First, I'm Irish-American. But if the, you know, that's why I like the phrase African American, because that's how I feel about myself, rather than white. Also, white and black, those are opposites. But there aren't white people. There aren't, but truly, in fact, you look on the street, on the subway, there's all kinds of shades of brown and beige. And so I think it's not a good – if we could get away from this black and white thing, which sets up an opposites that is not factually true. And the third thing is, I'd like to say, my foundation belief is all humans are equal. There is nothing anybody can do about it. We're all equal because no one knows what's going to happen next. We're all in the same situation. You ride in the subway and just look around you. You are there. Other people are there. The train is going. What's going to happen next? No one knows. So
especially
those are my three
subway
points.
Whitney, you want to talk to Michael? Michael, you want to talk to Whitney? Whitney, go ahead.
Yeah, Michael, no, I think it's – you know, I think you bring up a couple things. One, this idea that like there's all sorts of shades. I did this interesting project recently. I did an installation at the Tribeca Film Festival last year. We took pictures of everybody's skin and put them on a gradient, and sort of this idea of where does someone become white, where does someone become not white. But there's no denying that there is that you reap benefits by your skin color. So that even though saying, well, we're all equal, the reality is that we live in a structural society. I mean, people talk about white supremacy. The structure of America is built on the foundation of white supremacy. And when you say those words, people get very upset. They think that it feels pejorative. That's not even a pejorative statement. That's just a statement of fact.
The Constitution had it.
Yes. And the idea that doesn't like reflect into the present is just preposterous.
I do think that it is an unchallengeable fact that all humans are equal. All humans are equal. And now,
they don't seem to be treated equal.
Well, that may be. I mean, all kinds of temporary things happen of all sorts. I know. I can see the same world you guys see, and I have fundamental agreement with it. But the amazing thing is the great reassuring, the great strengthening fact of life is that we are all equal. All humans are equal.
No, and
no one can do anything about it. And now, yes, you can. There are temporary things that can happen, the situations you can work out, you can, and all that. And I know the history well as anybody, I guess, an ordinary American knows. But still, all humans are equal. And I just find that, I just walking down the street, I see people of all kinds, and I think, look at that. I just get amazed and strengthened in my heart and my soul to think that we're all equal.
You live in New York City. There's most people's walks do not have such a varied view as ours do.
Let me ask you one follow-up question to something you said, which I think is very, very common among white people. You said you don't think of yourself as white. You think of yourself as Irish-American. Does it challenge something? Does it make you feel uncomfortable in a specific kind of way?
No, I'm a white guy. I mean,
yeah.
In the world, I'm a white guy. I'm not pretending to something that isn't
yeah.
true. But I think the way African-Americans, there was Negro, there was colored person, all these things, and it's changed, and the system of politeness and just niceness between people is to call people what they like to be called. So that's gone from Negro to black to African-American. Of all those, I just like African-American best because it suits mm-hmm. me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I say, well, you're African-American, I'm Irish-American.
Yeah.
So here we are.
Michael, thank you. I really appreciate your call. Putting it in a national context, I think I understand his point on that. rather than a racial context about who everybody is. Of course, Africa isn't a nation. It's a continent of nations, and a lot of people whose ancestors came over as slaves can't even know what country their people
and
came from.
And many people who are, you know, who would appear to Michael as black are not from Africa.
Emily in Mamaroneck, you're on WNYC. Hi, Emily.
Oh, hello. How are you? I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I am, I identify first as American and then as Jewish, and I have a real, and I guess I know that I have been a person who's gotten white privilege and has definitely benefited from it, but I feel like I just can't understand any American who would say that they don't understand that the black experience has been a horrible, horrible one in this country, and that people who are of minorities don't deserve to have a leg up on a nation that has treated them so vilely. I mean, coming to this country, my ancestors, I mean, they did what they needed to do. They faced oppression. And just to not give that to other people, to say that they just don't have any understanding of why a black person would need that any kind of leg up in a society that abhors them in a way is completely ridiculous to me.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I would have liked to ask you that. You know, you said,
"Are you on?" She's there.
Yeah, but you know that you know, you say you're an American, you're Jewish, and then what she didn't say, which most women that I talk to say, that I'm a woman before I'm white, and that being a woman far impacts my life more than my white skin. But also, it's interesting because I've interviewed a lot of Jewish people in this project, and much like you in the opening of the show, I don't determine who's white when I ask people to come in. People come in who are biracial, multiracial. I want to talk to people about where whiteness fits in the equation. But one of the conversations that always is interesting that I've had with a number of Jewish people is whether Jews are white. And there's some Jews that I've interviewed who insist that because of their experience and discrimination face, they are not white and they are not treated white and that they don't have the privileges of white people.
Mm-hmm. Emily, anything you want to say about that from your own or your family's experience?
I grew up in a very clean suburb. I did not experience a lot of minority people in my area, but I always was built up with this idea from my parents, from my community, from my synagogue, that people were equal and that you should never ever look at people through the lens of their blackness or their Mexicanness. I mean, or their whatever, or their Indianness or anything like that. I just feel like it was so endemic in me and in people that I tend to be friends with. And I feel like it's this bigger cultural divide as abortion. I mean, I don't feel like there's common ground with some people who speak the way that previous speaker spoke.
Emily, thank you very much. This is something that we hear from white people a lot. I think that it's not what Emily said, but it touches on it. Feeling like, oh, there's an expectation on me to treat people of color as individuals and not members of their group, until the expectation becomes to treat them as members of their group. You know what I mean?
Well, I think the idea that that's not part of the equation when you interact with someone is preposterous, right? I mean, that we're all members of a group and we all have this certain baggage that we bring with us, but especially the relationship between black and white Americans, because it is this thing that is so much that we're at so much tension with. I think that one thing she said that I think is interesting, we've heard a lot already on the radio, is this idea of this investment in Americans, this idea of equality, and that over and over, I treat everybody the same, I treat everybody the same, I treat everybody the same, and yet the history of our country shows that we don't treat everybody the same.
And probably the history of ourselves, when we actually look at our behavior, shows that so many people don't treat everybody as the same as we think we're treating them.
Yeah.
We will talk later in the week, when we have a historian in this series, about another thing that you and Emily touched on, which was how the Jews in America became white, how the Southern Italians, who were once not considered white in certain respects, became white in the context of the United States, even the Irish.
Well, I love that, and that's in Dallas. I talked to a lot of multiracial people, and they one of this thing was this idea become white. Latinos, that I think something like 6 million Latinos between the last two censuses changed their designation from Latino to white. This idea that you become white, and there's a great interview. I encourage people to listen to it on the website. A guy named Nick who talks about he's a Latino young man who talks about trying to be white and becoming white and identifying as white.
He's so tortured. That video. Interesting to see on whitenessproject.org. Let me play one more. This is a minute of a young woman from Dallas named Leilani, who maybe would be reacting just to how much we're talking about this today.
I think I don't think about race because I don't talk about it. And the modern society is so obsessed with preventing a problem that all they do is talk about the problem, and that just fuels the problem. So, I mean, if we want to get rid of racism, stop talking about racism. And, I mean, just stop. And it's really not that hard. The reason I don't think about it is because I wasn't raised talking about it, because it didn't matter to us, because we were all different colors, but we were all family. So we saw each other as a family member, an aunt, an uncle, a niece, a cousin. We didn't see each other as Asian or white or German or whatever. We didn't see that. We saw, this is someone I love, not someone to be judged. And so I think that's the way that we could stop talking about it, is if we stop seeing each other as objects and start seeing each other as people, start loving each other more and not judging so harshly.
This is another thing white people say all the time. I think, stop talking so much about racism.
Exactly. And you're seeing it right now again in the NFL, like that you're bringing this into conversations where it shouldn't be brought in, the idea that you don't protest injustice on 9/11. And but I think, just to mention Leilani is biracial, and it's good to know that in that conversation that she's – I think she's – I want to say she's half Japanese, I believe. I'm sorry, Leilani, if I'm getting that wrong. But yeah, I think this idea that you – well, it's easy if you – I mean, I think that is something you hear a lot from white people, is that they don't know, they don't want to have this conversation. But in general, I think it is a hard conversation to have. And that's why – but the idea that Americans would stop having the conversation just seems impossible. It seems to be at the core of who we are.
What are you going to do next at whitenessproject.org?
The next thing is, one of the things, as I said, there's data points that end at the videos, and I've really felt for a long time that I'm a little bit like a filmmaker who's sort of doing, you know, trying to sort of structure this thing, when I was starting to research, there wasn't a lot of research out on white people. I had to sort of pull it out of other studies. So I recently created a partnership with Columbia University, with Peter Behrman at the Insight Institute, and we're starting a large scale sociological study on whiteness, built around the interviews that I'm doing. And over the next year, we're going to be interviewing 1,000 people, and he's putting together a team of sociologists to travel with me, and they're going to be taking the interviews, and they're taking data from everybody we interview, do historical data on the communities we're in, take DNA from everybody to build a database, a quantitative and qualitative database that people can access about how whiteness and attitudinal changes function both in the present and over time by nesting it in history.
How do you get people to attitudinal change? I mean, there's even in this conversation we've had and with some of the callers and listening to some of the clips, is there an element of scolding white people or saying, you know, okay, when you really understand what's going on, you're going to understand more that you do have white privilege, and we white people really have to do more in terms of racial justice that has not been reconciled yet in this country?
I think absolutely you don't scold. I think that first of all, I think it's the responsibility of white people to talk to white people. I think I've sort of taken the position that I'm not qualified to have cross-race discussions. I'm qualified to talk to my own community. I think that's the responsibility. I think that it's not about scolding. I think that I've found that white people are desperate to have this conversation. They're desperate to find spaces to have this conversation. And you know what? The other thing they're going to have to come to terms with, like, occasionally you're going to step in it and you're going to get, like, you know, you're going to get knocked around a bit. I'm sure Kate Upton, who tweeted about the National Football League, don't protest, is learning that today. When you engage this conversation, it's going to be complicated. But I can also tell you from somebody who's been working on this for a number of years, it's incredibly rewarding. And what the gains you come from engaging this is far greater than anything that you're going to lose.
Whitney Dow, you can see his amazing work at whitenessproject.org. All those videos of people from Buffalo and from Dallas. Our series, Facing Whiteness, will continue tomorrow with the head of a private school in Manhattan that's been in the news for the way it interacts with its students about whiteness and affinity groups, and a diversity consultant who goes into the schools. Whitney, thank you very much for doing today.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue this week's expanded edition of our 30 Issues election series, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. The country, including white people, talks a lot about race and the state of black America, for better or worse. But in a country whose electorate is so divided along racial lines, whiteness is a topic that barely gets raised as a public issue. If we are ever to have racial equity and reconciliation in this country, if we are ever to understand our individual differences and our national commonalities, we probably have to face whiteness as a specific thing with specific characteristics and challenges, not just an assumption of normality that white people don't even see. One institution that's beginning to face whiteness is our schools, both in curriculum and in extracurricular clubs. We have with us now two educators involved in that effort. Phil Kasson, director of LREI, also known as Little Red Schoolhouse, and Elizabeth Irwin High School, a private school in Greenwich Village in Soho. They were recently in some press coverage about the issue that led Mr. Kasson to send a letter to all parents, which we will read some excerpts from. And Derek Gay, an internationally known consultant to schools and other educational institutions on issues of diversity, inclusion, and global citizenship. He joins us from Tampa. Phil Kasson is in our studio. Phil and Derek, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
And Phil, your letter was largely about affinity groups and said LREI has them for students of color and from time to time has organized affinity groups for white students and may do so again. How do you see the purpose of any affinity group, and in what ways would those for white students be unique?
So we have a number of affinity groups for students who feel underrepresented in our community and maybe in the community at large, and have found that it gives them an opportunity to create a community for themselves, to problem solve, to feel some strength, to feel affirmed, to commiserate, to have a private place to speak. We have from time to time, and as I hope more and more, created affinity groups for white students to talk about their race, which often goes unspoken of in both in our community and I think in society at large, and to learn about how their race impacts their experience, the experience of their schoolmates.
Your letter to parents was very frank in a number of ways. You said our attention must shift, at least in part, to a discussion more generally of whiteness. And you said the goal of having white children talk about white privilege is not to tell them they are all racist. The goal is to acknowledge out loud and without equivocation that white privilege exists and to name it, discuss it, and grow. That's still very different than the kind of goal that you probably have for the other kinds of affinity groups, for black students or Latino students or LGBT students, which might be more to make them feel like they have a safe space in a context where they are some kind of minority.
Right. I think we can't have the same affinity group for every student as their experiences are all quite different. We need to have a maybe an equitable, you know, opportunity for students. Many of our students of color are having these conversations at home from the time they're quite young. They're experiencing their race from the time they're young. They're hearing it talked about at home. They're experiencing it on the street. They're experiencing it in school. White students don't experience their race unless we purposefully put it on the table in front of them. And I think that one of the things that happens in white affinity groups is that they start with students feeling, you know, I didn't ask for the privilege. I didn't I have friends who are students of color. I don't want people not to like me because of my race. We need to have a more consistent conversation so we can work through those feelings of guilt and discomfort and create opportunities for true understanding and long-term growth.
Derek, for you as a diversity and inclusion consultant to many schools, including some private schools here in New York, how do you see the purpose of any affinity groups, and in what ways would those for white students be unique?
Yeah, I would completely agree with what Phil just said. I think one of the challenges, well, typically an affinity group is around affirming identity and building community and problem solving and strategizing, as Phil mentioned, and often feeling as if we're in an interracial setting that often there's a differential of awareness around race, as Phil mentioned. So typically what we know from the research is that parents of color typically parent their children to make them aware of their racial identity, to prepare them for the racism that they will challenge or that they will encounter, and to provide counter narratives and messages around being proud of who they are. And that white parents largely teach their children that you should, you know, judge someone based on their character, and that racism is a horrible thing, and thank goodness that racism is over. And so whiteness is not named, as you mentioned earlier. So I think that in terms of thinking about equitable affinity groups, that when you're thinking about a white affinity group, it's an opportunity to raise awareness of the ways in which this racial frame is serving as a lens to interpret experiences and how we're viewing each other and how we're viewing others in ways that is not necessarily organic for whites, because typically if we look at the nature of racial discourse in this country, it's people of color are racialized beings, and whites either have no identity, or if they enter racial conversations, it's an opportunity to learn about the experiences of people of color to the exclusion of learning about themselves.
Listeners, we want your voices on this. Have you or your child been in a school setting where whiteness was discussed? What did you or your child learn? What does the country need in terms of education about white privilege and white diversity within white privilege and anything else? Listeners, how do you want to join this conversation? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Phil, I'm going to read a little more from your letter to parents, and you include this argument, really, and conversation starter. Do I ever feel as if I, Phil Kasson, white man, am being blamed for the unearned bias directed at African Americans? Yes, and then I get over myself. It's not about me. Moving through guilt, through defensiveness, through feeling put upon, through the personalization of this issue is a necessary moment in one's growth. This moving through is not a one-time event, but rather it is an ongoing component of dealing with the racism in the world and an ongoing part of a lifetime's development. The fact that my part in this struggle is an internal war with my feelings rather than an external danger is a privilege in and of itself, unquote. So that's very provocative stuff for a parent to get in a letter from the director of the school. Was that aimed at parents who might be thinking, my family didn't own slaves, my child has no history of racism, why educate us to have all this guilt?
Yes, and my goal in writing this was to let families know where we're headed and in many ways where we've come from, that if I'm in a room with other white educators, with colleagues in my school or elsewhere, and I'm feeling as a white person that I didn't ask for the privilege that with which I move through the world, and it makes me feel badly when someone looks at me in a certain way, I'm creating that guilt and that bad feeling, and it's unproductive other than its ability to push me ahead. And certainly people of color don't need me to feel guilty. They need me to understand how I move through the world and to hear from them their experiences moving through the world and to see where the intersection is.
Derek, as I'm sure you know, the New York Post version of this that stirred up a backlash when they chose to go after it was elite private schools teaching white students that they're all racist. Do you understand why it would look that way to some people, and how would you counter that narrative?
Yeah, so often when I enter these conversations around race, I often talk about, I mentioned earlier how racial discourse is often framed about, people, white people learning about people of color to the exclusion of thinking about whiteness. And I think about that positionality and how it may inform, if I have no sense of my own identity, how then the introduction of me learning about myself is framed as white privilege. So I have these advantages that I'm unaware of. I have no sense of my identity. I've always viewed this as being, I'm a good person, and being a good person is sort of this immutable state and not this ongoing social practice. Then I can understand how someone might take this as being reverse racist or what have you. But I also think that when we're thinking about journalism and research, that, to put that in sort of public discourse without, looking at what we know about race as a social construct, looking at what we know from child psychology of what young children are able to discern and understand about race at various developmental ages, is irresponsible. And so I think that a lot of what you're seeing sort of from the parent backlash of either affinity groups or work around whiteness is in part predicated by white parents not having done the work around learning more about their own racial identity. And also, I think, we think about white racial identity. In fact, when, people of color can say, I'm proud to be black, or I'm proud to be Puerto Rican, or I'm proud to be Asian, we often associate white pride with sort of white supremacists. So the whole notion that white people would get together to explore their racial identity is something that is novel. And I think what's scary about it is that if you acknowledge that there's something that you're unaware of, and this could potentially sort of modify your world construct, does this mean now that there are other things that I don't know about or I'm unaware of? So it's easier oftentimes to just disengage.
So talk more about that idea of pride, because I think you touched on something that a lot of white people think and don't know how to deal with earnestly, which is, if a black person has black pride, that kind of makes sense in the context of American history. If an LGBT person has gay pride, that kind of makes sense, in context. If somebody has pride as a white person, then it's like you're a racist. And so how do you deal with that pride issue? Because everybody should have pride in their background in some respect. Is it a matter of unpacking it? So you can have Irish pride and you can have Italian pride, but if you have white pride, then it means something else. Or for you as a consultant on all these things to schools, to teachers, to students, how do you address that?
Well, I begin with sort of thinking about, we have to start at the creation of whiteness, and part of the deal with whiteness was sort of, predicated on this integrationist or assimilationist model. So in coming to the United States and various European ethnic groups being assimilated into whiteness, part of it was giving up that ethnic pride. So you gave up being Italian, or gave up being Irish, or gave up being Czech, or what have you, to become white. And that whiteness then became this sort of abstract, unnamed racial identity that, allowed you privilege, being sort of a full citizen. But what's interesting is then with that privilege came this whole notion of sort of white pride being associated with white supremacy, and not thinking about sort of anti-racists who are involved in sort of in abolitionist movements and the like, and sort of whiteness and pride don't go together. And so often, a lot of scholars would think about, if you think about white pride, they think about part of that identity as being that of an anti-racist, or white pride as being part of having some type of ethnic pride. But I think it's, with the current way that, the paradigm has been structured, it's difficult to stand up and say, I'm white and I'm proud. And I think often the way people have gotten around that is sort of having a sense of or recognizing a sense of their identity and recognizing some of the challenges of white pride and then joining themselves to sort of anti-racist movements but still having a strong sense of who they are, but in different ways. I mean, it's not going to be the same mm-hmm. as black pride mm-hmm. or Latino pride or LGBT pride.
You know, Derek, I think in some ways that at least for speaking for my students and for myself, we're not ready yet to talk about being proud. We don't understand what it means to be white. We've never looked from the outside at what the white experience is to move to a place where we can then be proud of it. And that's where we try to start in the schools, whether it's through affinity groups or other conversations.
Let's take a phone call. Can I go to Dave? Can you release Dave's line? We were just going to start with Dave here. Dave in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to speak to this issue really quickly. My son went to a $50,000 a year prep school in Massachusetts for 3 years and had a tremendous experience in terms of, I guess, in terms of his own self-awareness about, you know, being an African-American and being exposed to so much discretionary wealth and privilege. The school that he went to did a tremendous job of, you know, talking about and creating forums for the kids to kind of really openly address the fact that, on the one hand, you know, kids were coming from, you know, working class families and in cities and places, you know, outside of Massachusetts. So they had to deal with that culture shock, and then, you know, had to deal with the other issue of being exposed to kids with a lot of money and whose families had a lot of money. I think the schools, this particular school, really went out of their way and did a tremendous job with my son in trying to help him to deal with, you know, the self-esteem and self-identity issues.
And what about, since you and your son are black, and I understand you're putting this in a class and income diversity perspective, was there also a whiteness piece?
Yeah, I mean, it was a culture shock for us all. I was exposed to, you know, other parents, you know, that came from a lot of privilege and wealth. And, I mean, people weren't ashamed of where they came from. At the same time, I think that they were cognizant and aware that, you know, I probably didn't, you know, share that same experience. Mm-hmm. And, I never got the sense that anyone was trying to flaunt their wealth or rub it in my face or make me feel inferior or feel not wanted.
Dave, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And let's go to Angelina in the Bronx. Angelina, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, good morning. It's Angelina. And I just wanted to add a little bit about the early childhood perspective. Both of my children attend Sarah Lawrence in Bronxville. And I, to the credit of the director, Lorraine, who's white herself, she brought in a diversity consultant last year to talk to parents about race in early childhood, because I think a lot of people don't think that children who are very young experience race. And the consultant brought out all of this research indicating that actually children as early as 6 months old are able to tell the difference between color of skin and race. And children, just out of who they are and being so young, they're curious and they also recognize difference. And they're also at various points in early childhood are trying to sort out the world and make sense of it. So the consultant shared research indicating that children, even as young as 2 and 3, are able to articulate differences in race and also judgment based on that. And so there was one study that she cited indicating that children, they gave children different color dolls, and all of the children picked the white dolls first. And then not only picked the white dolls, but when asked why they did that, they said because they're better. And this was children of color and white children.
Right, it's
and
a so very, very famous study. So, Angelina, how do you find that the school deals with the white children in this context, since our topic is facing whiteness?
I mean, again, to the credit of the school and to the director, they are very aware of these issues. And I think early on, you know, with parents, they talk about it. They bring in this diversity consultant. But also in the classroom, they make sure, I mean, also they try to make the school as diverse as possible, given the constraints of being in Westchester and also being more expensive than other preschools. But also in the classroom, they have books and dolls of all races that look different. They talk about differences of color, not in like a, you know, they don't racialize it necessarily, but they do acknowledge that children do recognize skin color, and they acknowledge it, and they let kids talk about it. And in the FIVES program, one of the teachers, they do self-portraits, and they do a lot of conversation when they do self-portraits, and they celebrate diversity. But also, I think Lorraine and the teachers are really clear that this is something that children experience, and that we need to talk about it now. Because
even children, that young, yeah, because children can see and experience. Anna Helena, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Derek, do you consult public schools as well as private schools?
I do. I do consult with public and private schools. And to what Angelita just said, I also consult with early childhood centers. And I'm a curriculum advisor for Sesame Street on Continent Curriculum. And all the research would support exactly what she just said, that children do see race at a very young age.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
At a very young age, and that by ages 3 to 5, that even in, you know, multiracial early childhood centers, that students are using race to create in and out groups in ways that they use gender as well, and that children understand race differentially. So young children maybe will not understand race as a construct, but certainly they're seeing different skin colors, and as they're becoming older, they're learning and taking in cues from society that this actually has social meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the issue again is not the children, it's that we haven't confronted many of these issues ourselves, and sort of this sort of post-civil rights movement, I'm colorblind, it really doesn't matter, so, when in fact children are absorbing these cues. You know, the brown doll test, as she cited, has been replicated over and over and over, and the findings have been consistent.
So how different is your approach to this sort of education in diversity or inclusion or whiteness or white privilege for kids growing up in white households that may not feel nearly as privileged as many of the affluent families or families in the affluent context that we've been talking about so far? Both our callers sent their kids to high-end private schools. Our other guest here, Phil Kasson, is, you know, director of a independent high-end private school in Manhattan. So kids of white firefighters and kids of white delivery people and kids of white factory workers, is it essentially a different conversation or the same conversation?
It's a very similar conversation, but an intentionality sort of teasing out class and race. And often, you know, people will conflate the two. As your initial caller spoke about going to an elite independent school, having the conversation around, again, asking people to think about some of their earliest messages around race. And often, I think, as you indicated, when you're dealing with families who aren't in elite institutions, some of the first responses is, you know, but I'm not rich, or, you know, my family worked hard, or I live in a multicultural neighborhood, and having them, while certainly recognizing intersectionality, to sort of tease out and focus on the race piece in and of itself, and think about some of the advantages that are associated with that. So whether you're rich or poor, that there's still going to be a higher likelihood that if you're a person of color, that you're going to be pulled over. You know, think of stop and frisk, or we think about, you know, differential use of police force along racial lines that aren't necessarily correlated around class lines.
Arlene in Fairhaven, you're on WNYC. Hi, Arlene.
Hi, Brian. So my son went to what's called a top 10 university, if you believe U.S. News and World Report. And he and the other white students there were, I think, continually told to check their privilege. But here's the thing. My dad, so his granddad, emigrated from southern Italy in the 20th century, was naturalized in 1931. I have visited the two-room shack in Sicily where my dad grew up with 7 siblings. I mean, I'm really talking dire, dirt-poor poverty. So, you know, when you look at a white person, you really don't know what you're looking at. And that's really all I want to say is that, you know, it's just a very simplistic way to define people, because how would you know what their background really is? There's only one generation standing between my kid and dire poverty.
I think that's a really difficult thing that's a complicated conversation that we have with our students. I mean, they say similar things. I think if you're looking at white students moving through the world, all students, whether they're one generation or 10 generations from poverty or immigration, they move through society with an assumption, with a privilege that our students of color don't. And that's exactly why we have this conversation.
Well, I get it. I mean, I'm just making the point that I just think that there need to be subtleties in this conversation about what you're seeing when you quote unquote see a white person. That's all.
Thank you very much. Well, in her book, White Trash, Nancy Eisenberg writes about a political ethnic triangle in this country that I think the caller touches on that's existed for a long time. White elites more inclined to endorse racial equality measures, but with the white lower classes feeling like it's coming at their expense. Derek, this may not include many students in the kinds of schools we've been talking about, but is that a triangle that you deal with, at least intellectually, in your consulting work?
Absolutely, and it is a complicated issue to deal with. Again, sort of, you know, teasing out class and race, and you know, Phil touched upon this. You know, the caller who mentioned her her grandfather being a naturalized citizen in 1919, even thinking about, you know, to become a naturalized citizen in the United States, based on the 1790 Naturalization Act, you had to be first declared a white person, and how whiteness changed over time. It wasn't until 1952 that those laws were taken off the book. But I think about when we talk about whiteness, you know, it's difficult to focus on whiteness without talking about the socioeconomic piece. And, you know, many scholars would agree that part of the construction of whiteness is certainly predicated in socioeconomics and creating this identity as a justification of sort of why we can create, you know, systems and policies where we can justify disproportionate allocation of resources to one group and not another. And if you think about political alliances and the like, and the creation of whiteness and why some might create political alliances with certain either parties, what have you, to the detriment of their own best interests, the saliency of whiteness, I think, becomes really important.
Derek, you're black. Phil, you're white. Do you feel your roles as educators need to be different in any way just from that fact? Phil, do you?
Sure. I have students who identify with a variety of races and ethnic identifications. I need to play a role for all of them. But I also think for, you know, my school is, I don't know, 65-70% white. I need to demonstrate to the white majority in the school what it means to be a white person in our community and how one can grow in that identity.
Derek, same question.
I am aware of sort of the racial lens and how it impacts how I navigate the world and also how people perceive me, and how I use it as a heuristic or a number, as one of the many lenses that I use in thinking about how I differentiate my approach and navigate education.
How important is it that there are people like Phil in the world who are white and taking activist stances on this as educators?
Critically important, because the expectation is that I will naturally gravitate to this work, and the expectation probably also is that I don't have any scholarship, and I'm just speaking about my experiences. So to have someone like Phil who is part of the structure, and to have someone like Phil who has the power and agency of role and the like to be involved in affecting change is critical. And we also just know that people will hear, particularly around race, this message differently from Phil than they will from me. So people like Phil are critically important to moving the needle.
Now, before you both go, we're doing this in the context of our 30 Issues election series. Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. We'll continue it all this week. We'll eventually, later in the week, get to how the candidates have faced or not faced whiteness. But is there any way in which you could say that the educational context ties into the political or even presidential race context, Derek?
In as much as I feel that race is not taught as a social construct, or education around race and racial literacy are not integrated in what we do in education, I think it informs an incomplete racial analysis that informs how people create alliances, and I think that's playing out big time in what we're seeing in the presidential race right now.
And Phil, kind of same question. Even in our last hour when we were talking about the basket of deplorables comment mm-hmm. and the isms that was tied to or anything that inspired that comment, are these teachable moments? Can you educate around that without censoring yourselves, even as you certainly don't want yourself or your faculty to be partisan?
No, we don't. But I think that the students would notice if we weren't talking about these important moments in American current events. And if we just talk about the election and the candidates without talking about how they intersect with the other things that my students, for instance, know are important to us as an institution, it would ring untrue to them. So to speak about this election without speaking about the racial overtones or the religious overtones in some of what's been said, I think would be dishonest.
Phil Kasson, director of LREI, also known as Little Red Schoolhouse and Elizabeth Irwin High School, private school in Greenwich Village in Soho, and Derek Gay, internationally known consultant to schools and other educational institutions on issues of diversity, inclusion, and global citizenship. Thank you for having a piece of a very hard conversation with us today.
Thanks for having me, and nice to hear from you, Derek.
Thanks very much. Looking forward to continuing this critical conversation.
Yeah, and one of our listeners, Julie Raimondi, tweeted, "I don't have a personal racial identity. You'd call me white. My identity doesn't include my race. That's what white privilege is." And maybe that tweet is a good place for us to pick this up on social. Use the hashtag #FacingWhiteness, the title of this series, Facing Whiteness, and talk with us about what white privilege is, especially if you're white and you've been thinking about it. What in your life in your life experience is an expression of your privilege? What in your life that you can explain in 140 characters is the manifestation of your white privilege or even beyond privilege to however you are facing whiteness? Use the hashtag Facing Whiteness and let's keep this important conversation going, and we'll keep it going with different segments on the air all week. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, stay with us. More to come. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now a call-in for anyone who is multiracial, including part white, on the question, how do you relate to your whiteness? 212-433-WNYC. This is part of the special expanded edition this week of our 30 Issues election series, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. We'll get to the candidates and whiteness later in the week, but let's have this conversation about it now. If you're multiracial, including part white, how do you relate to your own whiteness? 212-433-WNYC. For one thing, maybe you're just aware of your whiteness as a thing, more than other white people are. If we've learned anything by talking about whiteness this week, the first thing is probably that compared to people of color who are constantly made aware of their difference from the majority, white people rarely think of their whiteness as a thing at all. It's like if you have hands, do you consider yourself, oh, I'm a person with hands? You just don't think about it. So if you're mixed race, including part white, do you think you're more aware of your whiteness than people who are all white? And if so, how does that affect your sense of identity? What is the white part of yourself to you? 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. Are you proud of the white part of your heritage? You know, on yesterday's show, I asked a question about if there is such a thing yet as white pride post-white supremacy, white pride that is not white supremacy, in a country that will soon have no ethnic majority of any kind. And so if we have black pride and Latino pride and there's no ethnic majority in the country, can white people have white pride? And I got this response from Phil Kasson, director of the LREI school, which includes ethnic awareness in its education. He's not ready for that.
We're not ready yet to talk about being proud. We don't understand what it means to be white. We've never looked from the outside at what the white experience is.
We've never looked from the outside at what the white experience is. But people who are multiracial probably have looked from sort of inside and from sort of outside at your own whiteness, some of you. So we want to hear from you, and that could be one of the questions. Are you proud of the white part of your background? Or conversely, are you ashamed? White people can definitely feel shame about their whiteness sometimes. Do you feel you sort of get it about both sides of the racial conversation in this country? If you're mixed, or at least two sides, if you're mixed, do you react differently from other people of color you know when you hear Rudy Giuliani or Donald Trump or people less contentious but still with sort of politically white points of view on things? Here's President Obama from his famous 2008 campaign speech on race, in which he talked about not being able to disown Reverend Jeremiah Wright, remember him, who had said some racially controversial things that Obama didn't agree with, and he compared that to things he didn't like about his own white grandmother.
I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love.
President Obama in 2008. So who among you relate to that about something from your white side? Do you feel that certain things you do come from your white side, certain things from your other side, whatever that is? Do you stereotype yourself in any respect? 212-433-9692. And while we're getting some of you ready with our screeners as your calls are coming in, I'm going to play one more clip. On Monday's show, we played excerpts from a collection of interviews with white people on their whiteness called The Whiteness Project. You can see all their stuff. It's really interesting at whitenessproject.org. So here's another one from that. It's a guy around 20 years old who says he's half white, half Mexican, and he's obviously all mixed up. He lives in Dallas, and his name is Nick.
Well, I think I'm kind of, you know, I identify as white, but I'm half Mexican and half white. My mom's, she's Mexican, and my dad, he's from New York, and he's white. In school, I would say more socially, I hang out with primarily white people. I have mostly white friends, and say if when I'm taking a test or something like the ACT or something, I check the white / Caucasian box. I realize that maybe I could have gotten some scholarship money if I said I was Hispanic, for just to trying to fill their minority quotas that they have. But I felt like if I did that, I'd be like a hypocrite, and because I don't, I really do not have, other than me, my mom being Hispanic, I really have no other affiliation with that. I kind of feel like the fact that I'm sometimes hiding that I'm Mexican, I feel like I'm disrespecting my mom. I'm not saying I'm not Hispanic or Mexican. I'm just not saying that I am. Like, I'm just not telling people or in my friends group. And it just makes me feel like I can't, I have to hide who I am. And I feel like I shouldn't have to. And I don't like that I do sometimes, but, and it makes me feel weird about the people I'm hanging out with, and sometimes I question why I'm hanging out with these people, but I end up doing it anyways.
Nick from Dallas, interviewed by The Whiteness Project, the founder of The Whiteness Project, who was our guest on Monday. Whitney Dow said Nick was probably the most heartbreaking of the stories that he heard, and you hear how mixed up he was. And who wants to react to Nick's story or tell us if you relate in any way? And those are some conversation starters for this call-in, a call-in for anyone who is multiracial, including part white, on the question, how do you relate to your whiteness? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Carola in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Did I say your name right?
Yes, you did. Hi.
Hi.
I am, I guess I'm actually tri-racial because I also have Native American. I am very proud of all my ancestry, and I've always identified as mixed. But from a fairly young age, we were aware that of our the history of our slave owner and slave ancestry, because it's been documented, and it was very interesting. And I learned that the slave owner ancestor, whose partner, my great grandmother, bore him 8 children, and eventually he freed them all and educated them all. So my great-grandfather is, well, I guess it was a great-great. Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather was very well educated and became a prominent politician in Galveston, Texas. And so that's when I started researching my family history. But my brother and I, my brother looks completely white, so he's... And you never really thought as much about it as I have.
Oh, and that's interesting in and of itself. The fact that he looks white has led to him not thinking about it as much as you have because you're darker?
Yeah, but historically, he's just as interested in it. It's just that he didn't... Well, I can't say that I experienced more as being black either, because... I just look brown, and people don't know what I am. So it's rather amusing because I get taken for Indian, I mean, like mm-hmm.
So
Indian,
on the,
Pakistani,
on the specific
Hispanic.
Topic of the call-in, how do you think all of what you just said about your background creates a relationship? What relationship do you have to your whiteness, if you can put that into words at all?
I guess it's a little hard to put into words because I don't think of it as much because it's sort of the baseline culture. So I identify with it in terms of genealogy, because my mother's genealogy is very interesting too. And she's a Mayflower descendant, although her... That this certainly had no financial impact. Her
so
family
you're
was
descendant
not
of slaveholders and Mayflower riders.
Yes, and Native Americans who we can't identify. But
and do
but
you have the, pride, shame, anything?
I'd say I have pride about all of them. The Mayflower descendant is interesting because he's famous for having fallen off. He was the cabin boy. And he was swept overboard in a storm in Plymouth Harbor and was pulled back on. And there's a joke that if the rope that pulled John Howland back onto the Mayflower had broken, half the people in Connecticut would be somebody else.
Wow. You've got some background there. Carola, thank you very much for starting us off. I really appreciate it. Anthony in Port Chester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Brian. You know, for me, my grandmother was born in 1878, and her mother was born in 1841, and my grandfather was white. And my grandmother had blue eyes, my father had blue eyes, and I have blue eyes, and very light skin. And when my mother used to take me out, people used to think she was watching me, that she wasn't my mother. But having lived in Florida for 13 years, my skin has gotten a lot darker since then. But the thing I find about being black with blue eyes is that people, white people are easier around me than they are around someone like, say, my middle son who is dark. You know, I see people, I can tell people are much more easy around me than they are darker black people when they pass them in the street. Even before they see my blue eyes. But once they see my blue eyes, that's a conversation point for white people all the time. Where did you get those fantastic eyes? Mm. And I wanted to tell them, where do you think?
Do you think?
Where would you think I would get blue eyes?
Right.
I'm white blood. I'm not ashamed of it anymore, though.
Were you?
I'm not ashamed of it. I was ashamed of it when I was younger because I was teased about it. I lived in the projects in Yonkers, and I was teased about it as a kid, you know. And as a teenager, I was teased about it because that's the only way girls would like me because I have blue eyes and I'm white.
So
and yeah, I didn't like it then.
Did you have the experience of feeling white in a mostly black environment in the projects growing up, or being perceived by others, I should say, as white?
As being perceived by black people as white.
Yes. And so how do you think that contributed to who you became as a person or how you think about race?
Well, you know, it gave me growing up in the 60s, I had great parents. So, and I was raised around a lot of white kids in the projects when I lived there. So, you know, I didn't see that racism like that until I went down south.
Mm-hmm.
And that scared me. The first time we were denied service in a restaurant, it scared me. I didn't want to stop anywhere ever, you know, on the way down there at all. But, you know, white people are very nice to me. They always, you know, wherever I'm at, especially when they see my eyes, then it's a wrap. You know, I think they think I'm just one of them at that point.
Do you think your experience being kind of, you know, across the lines in the way that you've been holds any lessons for people who are just white for what they can learn about how to think of themselves or how to see the world?
No, I don't think so.
Mm. It's just you being you.
Yeah.
Anthony.
That's just me being me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Hai Ting in Ridgewood, Queens. You're on WNYC. Hello, Hai Ting.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I am half Chinese and half Jewish, and as my Chinese father used to say when I was growing up, all American, mm-hmm. which is the only way to be when you're mixed race in America. But I think there is a lesson for, I hate to use this phrase, but white people from mixed racial existence, because you, as a mixed race person, you become hyper aware of how much race is a construct of people's perceptions of you from mm-hmm. the outside,
mm-hmm.
no matter how you feel on the inside. And I grew up with very little Chinese community. I grew up Jewish. I was bat mitzvahed, and I feel entirely Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But no one looks at me in America and thinks, oh, there's a good Jewish girl.
They see your eyes and they say you're an Asian girl.
Exactly. And then the one time that I went to China as a tourist, no one believed that I was Chinese at all. All they perceived was the foreign part of me to them, the whiteness.
Uh-huh.
So everyone perceives immediately what is foreign about you rather than what is familiar, which is definitely contrary to that last caller. I find that very interesting to hear from him that white people see the part that's familiar.
And when people who are Chinese, I guess, see you as white, how do they relate to you differently? Is it just as other, an otherness, or is it with particular characteristics or particular deference or particular disdain or anything in particular?
It's hard for me to say because I only had the one brief experience.
Yeah.
In China, and the Chinese culture is so unabashed about staring and pointing and picking out what is foreign.
Hmm.
But I had essentially the same experience as the white tourists that I went with, where people stop and remark and stare at you in the street in China, at least in the cities where I was at that time, which was uh-huh. quite a long time ago now.
But
living as a mixed race person, you are hyper aware of how much race is not an internal feeling. Race is what people impose on you from the outside.
Does it lead you to any political conclusions, since we're doing this in the context of our presidential election series, 30 issues? Do you think that there need to be policies? Do you think white politicians need to be aware of things that maybe they're not, who are all white?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head in those terms. In fact, it's strange that I've never thought about it, but I do have a sort of knee-jerk reaction when people talk about race as a thing that exists in the world objectively. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how I would shape policy around it, because no matter how much a construct of culture race is, the fact is that culture exists and we make policies within culture. So we have to deal with it. But I think that maybe I should take a slight tangent here and answer the question that you've been asking, which uh-huh. is how I experience whiteness. Because
yes.
As I said, I sort of feel, and on the inside, I feel sort of white, maybe secular Jewish, but very much a sort of, I feel like a standard American, which in this day and age is still white. And I with all this talk of whiteness and racial tensions, I often, hearing the news and policies, I feel a sort of knee-jerk white guilt. Mm-hmm. And then I do a kind of interior double take and say, wait, I'm not white. I actually have to feel that?
Uh-huh. So to get rid of the guilt, you deny half of your identity.
I don't know about that. It's just sort of you have a sort of double vision. You're always seeing the world from two different directions, mm-hmm. which I think helps mixed race people have empathy for all different kinds of ways of being in the
yes.
world racially.
Hi, Ting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mark in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Brian. I found that very interesting to see other people's truths, and I can see a lot of that in myself, too. But I think there's sort of shifting prisms of how race is perceived and reacted to.
You want to tell us your own background a little first?
Yeah. I mean, okay, what is white? So I look white for the most part to everybody. You know, here in New York City, I'm not a ginger-looking white, but my background is, I found out from one of the genetic tests, is I'm 47% European. There are no whites in my family. My mother looks like she could be Greek or Italian. Mm-hmm. And when I go in Greek stores, people speak Greek to me, or they speak Italian, or they speak Spanish to me. I was born in Harlem, but I have Negro on my birth certificate because I was born in Harlem. And my family is a little bit similar to your first callers. You know, they've been here for a long time, and they were mixed from the beginning. But we have a strong Native American ancestry. So many people think I'm either Hispanic or they think I'm Filipino. And even Chinese and Asian people will speak to me in Chinese, or when I'm in Japan, they'll ask me, are you Japanese, right?
Really?
So, yeah, now, I grew up in Harlem, so I went through a lot of flack because, of course, we look, you know, essentially, if you look like you could be Greek, well, then, you know, and you're in Harlem back in the 60s, you could get in a lot of problems. And I wanted to get away from that. Everybody thought I was white, and so I had constant problems with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Went to school up in the Bronx, Evander Childs. I learned Italian and hung out with a lot of Italians. But then when I heard the racism coming from my peers who were white, that kind of changed me and made me become much more attached to the sort of like non-white side of me, if that makes any sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt that the racism that black folks encountered, that they directed to me, was caused by guys like that. And of course, you know, learning about the history and the politics of the country and everything else, and getting more into my Native American ancestry. I think being black, you know, you said, well, we have gay pride, we have black pride, so we should have white pride. Black pride is not really about race.
Well,
so
I didn't say we should. I didn't say we should. I said I was just kind of raising
that
question.
Like,
are we headed that way?
I know what you mean. But I'm just saying this I think is an important point. The whole black identification thing is more cultural or national then it is racial.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a reaction that says, well, they don't know what country they came from. They don't know what particular ethnic tribe they belong to. There is white pride. I mean, there's Italian Day parades and Steuben Day parades. So whites take pride in their ethnic background because they know what country they come from, right? Whereas African Americans don't. So what they did was that African American background got morphed into a general black. And Larry Williams talks about this sort of thing. You look at his show, and you had, you know, many of the comedians ranging in all colors. And I think it's Robin Thebes, I think her name is. If you saw her, you would never think that she was black.
Uh-huh.
So, but she definitely was identifying with being black. So black is more like a nationality thing than it is a racial thing. And for me, you were talking about, well, how do you feel about the whiteness that's in you? I'm going to miss President Obama when he was gone. It really meant a lot to me to see a black family in the White House. The fact that he's racially mixed and everything, I could identify with that. And the speech that you played is I could identify with just about everything that he said, right? But the thing is that I do feel a little bit of resentment to whites because I have had them be racist to me. It was, well, where are you from? You know, you look a little bit different, right? If they're used to the Northern European sort of white folks, and I've felt that. So all of that comes together where it's like a shifting sort of perception, right, of what you are and who you are, and then you react in a shifting way. It's so interesting, the woman who's part Chinese, because Chinese people will ask me, you know, are you part Chinese? And then they're really nice to me, you know, because I can speak Chinese, too. I learned it. So when I grew up, what I learned was I learned how to navigate through and identify with all the different people that are here in the city. And right now, New York is much more multiracial than it used to be when I was a kid. I just wish I could have grown up in this New York, because we don't know who anybody is now.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody who looks Dominican could be Egyptian.
Right.
You know, they could be Pakistani or whatever. So yeah. I find that taking in all those different cultures and blending in with everybody is really a good thing.
So as somebody who, it sounds like, has felt the sting of racial bias from both black people growing up and white people later.
Right.
Is there any lesson that you could start to put into words about how we come together as a nation through policy or on some other level?
I'll say this, and it may not sound so good, but I'll say this. Black people are not really racist. They're just reacting to everything that's around them and gets reinforced in them to have resentment. They're not racist, they're resentionist. But the problem with whites is that there are some deep things where they don't like the other. Not everyone, of course, you know, we're not talking about everyone, but there is that element. We're looking at this and we look at what Hillary said about the deplorables, and you've quoted the polls that talked about the sentiments of, let's say, a third or 30% or 25% of Donald Trump supporters.
Uh-huh.
Those people, I'm not sure we'll ever be able to reach out to them. Hopefully we can. We're hoping that over time, our combined culture that we're making this in this country, you know, we've got hip-hop and pop and R&B music where artists of all shades and everybody listens to the same music. As we grow together culturally, that's going to whittle away and get less and less and less over time. But I think that whites should not react towards what they perceive as black racism and saying it's racism. No, it's just resentionism. That whites themselves have to look inside and realize why they're getting these reactions that they're getting and not react like the Trump folks do. And just bear it a little bit and realize that, yes, they're going to change. We're all going to blend. And, you know, my niece is married to a Jewish guy, and my niece's kids are bat mitzvahs as well. So now I've got Jewish family. I have a daughter that's part Korean. So this is what we're going to blend into. Obama represents that. Sister's half Indonesian. This is what we're going to go. It's a good place. So but it's going to take time because there are some hardcore people who just don't know how to perceive this and react to it properly.
Mark, thank you so much. And we're going to leave that there for now. Thank you all so much who called and got on the air for being so open. And that's today's installment of this expanded edition of our 30 Issues election series, issue 23, Facing Whiteness. So it was a call-in, if you just joined us, for anyone who is multiracial, including part white, on the question, how do you relate to your whiteness? We will continue with this series tomorrow and Friday. Tune in then. And we have more other things to do on this show today, so stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.